Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Political Football, the new podcast that digs into the global political stories behind the sport. I'm Jason Cowley, editor of The New Statesman.
And I'm Stephen Bush, special correspondent at The New Statesman. This is a special series devoted to the 2018 World Cup, and over the next few weeks we're going to be following all the action in Russia and analysing it with our guests.
And our first guest today is John Bew, Professor of History and Foreign Policy in the War Studies Department at King's London, and one of our favourite writers. And John's here to discuss the history of the World Cup, how globalisation has changed the World Cup, and anything else you want to talk about, John. Welcome. So, Stephen, are you looking forward to the tournament? I think it begins on Thursday this week.
Yeah, so much to my surprise, I usually take a while to get into a World Cup, because this is going to sound really silly, but I've never really enjoyed them until I get a sense of what their narrative is, you know, like who the World Cup's villain is, who the teams you're rooting for are, how England are going to do if they're participating. And slightly to my surprise, this time I am actually quite excited about it, despite my kind of general cynicism about the World Cup as a tournament.
And John, what about the fact it's held in Putin's Russia?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a lot of World Cups have been political beforehand, and there's a lot of focus on this. We're in this weird situation where our own Foreign Affairs Committee released a report last week warning about the problems that England fans travelling around following England may face in Russia. So there's a shadow of hooliganism, which is kind of gives it a retro, unfortunate retro 70s, 80s feel. There's the ostracization of Russia. There's no sort of big game on the horizon like Iran versus USA that you've had a previous World Cup. So the group stages don't throw up any of those sort of geopolitical clashes. But that sort of mood music is in the background, and there's certain questions over you know, how the thing's gonna play out. And then there's the sort of the doping thing, Russia's involvement in doping additionally. So it's not only Russia as the geopolitical mischief maker, there's also Russia as the country with this odd relationship with sport. All that having been said, all that skepticism, I can't help but get excited a week before the World Cup, and it just all kind of falls out the window. And when people were suggesting perhaps that England should withdraw from the World Cup, I'm a Northern Ireland fan, but even then I was slightly panicky and thought, no, please don't ruin our summer.
Yeah, this was in the aftermath of the Salisbury poisoning. And Stephen, I think that would have been a disastrous mistake by Theresa May, wouldn't it, if she'd pulled the England football team out of the World Cup while the rest of the world was there enjoying the opportunity to play football, even though they're playing football in Putin's Russia. I mean, surely that was the right decision to send the England team.
I actually crunched the numbers on this, because obviously this argument of it handing him a propaganda victory, and you kind of ask yourself how much that really matters in a managed democracy, to use the kind of Chatham House definition of how Russia's politics work. And actually, when you look at the performance of incumbent governments after World Cups, there is no evidence that they receive any kind of internal political boost. And also, I would have missed the opportunity to watch England go out limply at the quarterfinals. So,
well, I think we'll hold on our England predictions for now. But although you've given us an early indication as to what you're thinking. John, you talk about the geopolitics of the World Cup. I mean, football has become one of the supreme instruments of soft power. For Putin, it's not about the football, you know, what happens on the pitch. What it is about having the whole jamboree take place on Russian soil. Similarly, for the Qataris, who will be hosting it in 4 years, it's a statement of intent, isn't it?
It is. That having been said, I think past World Cups don't quite compare to Olympics. Olympics, ironically, while they're supposed to be more international, actually, you know, host nations often have tried to own them as prestige thing. Also, Winter Olympics in recent Russian case as well. Actually, it's hard to think of a previous World Cup in which someone's managed to sort of dominate the narrative. And I don't know if that, you know, is because football has a kind of democratic quality to it, or it's just so international it can't be owned like that. But I'm actually struggling. I'm racking my brain thinking of a really highly politicized World Cup.
Well, there was Argentina 78.
Yeah, well, which had a lot of a political background and issues to it. But was that quite owned in the same way?
Not in the same way. And then I remember, I'm older than you two, I remember the World Cup in Germany in 74, West Germany, when Germany was divided, of course. And there was a famous encounter during that World Cup where West Germany played East Germany. East Germany had also qualified. And the East Germans beat the West Germans 1-0. And I remember as a very young boy watching that game on television. Whether it was a huge geopolitical moment, I don't think so. Aren't we witnessing an evolution of the World Cup to becoming something much closer to the Olympics?
The weird thing is that one of the reasons why Argentina 78 was dominant is Argentina were a much better team than this Russia side. So one of the slightly weird things about it is that, barring a miracle, Russia's participation in this World Cup, rather like South Africa's in 2010, is likely to be brief.
The only thing is, they've got quite an easy group.
Yeah.
That's my only caveat, but I'm sorry, I'll hand over to
Matthew. Yeah, true. They do have quite an easy group, so it's a possible. But even so, you know, they're the weakest team, according to FIFA rankings, in the continent. But we do seem to be entering an era where, well, I guess we've seen it already in the club game. If we think about the Premier League, where two of the sort of most dominant clubs in the last decade are owned by oligarchs of one shape or another. They have become rich man's playthings. So I guess the kind of use of it as reputation laundering is going to become more acute. Weirdly, I feel a lot more uncomfortable about the Qatar World Cup than this one. The treatment of workers in the construction of those facilities just makes it so hard, and for me impossible, to disentangle the tournament in Qatar from the awfulness of the regime there, whereas I'm less bothered by the Russian World Cup, but that may, of course, just be me being wet.
I think that's a fair enough comment, actually. I mean, also, Russia is historically a big beast in football. I mean, it's had a, you know, bad 20 years or so, but does have, you know, serious Champions League teams as well, and sort of can make a decent play. The Qatari World Cup, and without getting too much details on the sort of corruption charges, you can make a legitimate case for Russia as a World Cup. And also, when they applied, the situation with Putin wasn't so fractious with the rest of the West. Also, you know, the World Cup is not the West's preserve. Qatar is something a little bit more dodgy and you know, even illogical, given that you're going to have 42 degree heat in the midst of
it. Although they're going to move it to the autumn, aren't they? It's going to be, in effect, it's going to be a winter World Cup. I think it's November or December. It's going to be hosted in Qatar when the temperatures will be, what, 21, 22?
But what a disastrous thing to move our World Cup from the, you know, from the summer to the winter. But the whole point of it is to keep us alive and keep us interested during the summer.
But this is the consequence of what has happened to football, and particularly the way that FIFA was run under the regime of Blatter, who, as you know, is associated with any number of corruption charges at present.
Absolutely. I mean, actually, in that sense, you have to give the Premier League some credit as compared to a lot of other national leagues. There's things it does that are, you know, flawed. And I think taking away from the national game is one of them. And you can see a pretty weak England team partly because of that. That having been said, if you compare it to, for example, the Spanish league, you know, the spread of football money across the board has created a kind of in a sense that Manchester United and Liverpool, if they're in another national league, would take all Arsenal as well. I know with two Arsenal fans, but the big clubs would take all the TV money. Premier League's actually handed out things a little bit more generously across the board. So, you know, in that sense, you know, be thankful with our own institution. FIFA and UEFA has its difficulties as well. These supranational governing bodies have been hugely problematic for the direction of the game over the last 25 years.
Just on the Russia's group, I've just got my little guide here, one of the supplements that are falling out of the newspapers. Russia's group, Group A, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Uruguay. So an easy group? Who said it was an easy group?
I think it's a relatively easy
group. Do you?
For a home nation. Yeah, I don't. I mean,
Egypt have the brilliant Salah if he's fit.
But is he fit? The
even more brilliant Elneny, the Arsenal midfielder.
Yeah, of course.
Well, obviously, yeah, with the great Elneny, you've, yeah, that team's going to carry all before it. I mean, it feels to me that the kind of I'm not going to pretend I have any inside track into what goes on in Egypt's training squad, but this whole kind of background noise of, oh, you know, he'll probably be properly fit for the second game, but he won't be quite fit for the first game. I can already feel that what will happen is Salah will play all three games and he clearly won't be fit for any of them. And it will be, I think, a slightly sad subplot to the tournament as a whole. But equally, I still think Egypt are a better team even without their star player than Russia. Uruguay are obviously a better team than Russia.
I think Russia are in trouble in this group, John. I mean, Uruguay, I presume Suarez is fit. I mean, he knocked England out last time around 4 years ago with a playing on, in effect, on one leg. I mean, he had a chronically injured knee, but he still managed to score two goals and knock England out. So I think Russia may be in trouble. The opening game is spectacularly uninteresting. It's Russia versus Saudi Arabia. I don't think I'll be watching that one.
Well, if Russia should beat Saudi Arabia first game, 3 points, then what have they got to do? You know, a draw and a win of the other two games. I think they've got a decent chance. Egypt also don't travel well. They also scrape through the last minute penalty by Mo Salah. They don't play with the same sort of fluency that his goal scoring record for Egypt, you know, understandably isn't as effective. What he does, Salah, for the Egyptian national team is kind of bear the weight of emotional responsibility, and that's the penalty scored in qualifying. It's most. I recommend anyone listening to this podcast or YouTube, it has a kind of incredible outpouring of emotion. But beyond that, I think the Egyptian team are actually pretty weak, and a home nation, psyched up home nation, should be able to, you know, at least get that draw, if not win.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Another thing that's slightly disappointed me about this World Cup, when you look at the timing of the games, they're at sort of 1 p.m., 4 p.m. when we're at work, and then 7 p.m. I often like the rhythm of a World Cup, where particularly those South American World Cups, where you watch a game about 7:45, and then there's another game at 10:45 in the evening. I used to really like that. I was thinking particularly the year I took my A levels, which would have been when 1986. That was during a World Cup, and I very much enjoyed the late match at about 10:45. In the evening, having done a little bit of revision, reluctantly, and then gone downstairs and watched a match.
It's Mexico World Cup, that was?
Mexico World Cup, where Gary Lineker was leading the England attack. Are you looking forward to what I call the rhythm of a World Cup, Stephen? Live matches on BBC, ITV, the chatter in the paper, the chat on podcasts, the emergence of possible players you don't know about?
Well, similarly, I prefer one where it's on the Southern Hemisphere. Yeah. That was the great thing about 2014. Not least, actually, the other fun thing about 2014 is lots of European embassies were gearing up to do a charm offensive with kind of various pro-European journalists to try and keep us in the EU, which obviously didn't work quite so well from a soft power perspective. But it did mean that I got to see a lot of those games in the host country, as it were. So I was in Germany when they put seven past Brazil, and it was a wonderful party atmosphere. And it was,
you were in the German embassy.
In the German embassy, yeah. When it happened. Yeah, so technically, from a legal perspective, if I had committed a crime in that embassy, I would have been in Germany. But because it's at 1 and 4pm, well, I feel I can't really say in this building, yes, I am planning to sack off work at crucial moments to watch the 1 and 4pm games. So it won't have quite the same rhythm. I am planning to watch the opening game because I always feel you've got to watch the opening game to kind of get into the rhythm of it. But I think also the other sad thing in terms of the stuff we've been talking about in terms of globalization and its impact on the game, although I love the Champions League, it has, I think, hurt the World Cup quite badly in two ways. The first is the excitement of World Cups past, of teams coming from strange parts of the country playing strange parts of the world playing strange formations. Everyone is basically going to play 4-2-3-1 or some variation on Juve's back three, as England are. So you don't have that kind of weird and wonderfulness. And it's not the pinnacle of the sport. The Champions League final, despite the goalkeeping not being the pinnacle of the sport by any stretch of the imagination, is the pinnacle of it as a kind of athletic and sporting excellence, which does take away from the joy of the World Cup. And I think will be even more of a problem in Qatar when it'll be in that old slot than did so much harm to the African Cup of Nations.
Yeah, that is a good point, John, I think, isn't it? Those of us who watch the Champions League, as we three do, we're so familiar with the players. And especially if you even watch the early group stages of the Champions League, when you maybe watch the lesser clubs who don't end up in the quarterfinals or the semifinals, but some of the Portuguese clubs, for example, or some of the Dutch clubs, you become familiar with the emerging talent in the game, as well as, of course, the big stars. I guess the player last time round that surprised me, I didn't know a lot about, was James Rodriguez, a name I can't even pronounce now, who I think was then a Colombian player, playing with
Monaco to Madrid. And
then
Bayern.
He ended up at Madrid. He's now at Bayern. I thought he was sensationally good last time round. But are you concerned about that? There are players out there that might surprise you, or do you think you know everyone?
No, I mean, to Stephen's point, you're unlikely to get the sort of Cameroon of Italia 1990, who came in and sort of just knocked everyone over. Yes. And of course, in that famous first game against Argentina, went pretty far in terms of stretching England as well. I mean, really exciting.
All the way
team.
To the quarterfinals.
All the way
England.
To the quarterfinals, yeah. So, you know, that I think that's less likely, that sort of, you know, clash of footballing styles. You'd hope someone sort of would, you know, come from left field. That having been said, I mean, if you take the sort of last 10, 15 years of Euros and World Cups, you do get surprise packages. You know, you get the Portugals who, you know, actually beyond Ronaldo and a few other players are competent, technical, but not full of, you know.
Well, they kind of bored their way to the Euro victory, didn't they?
Greece.
And
you have a Brazil team actually playing pretty well and confident. It's sorted out, I think, at centre-halves, which had that problem at the last World Cup. And actually do play with a sense of romance. French football team at the moment, in terms of the way they play, the attacking flair and pace is actually pretty exciting as well. So I mean, you know, oddly, some of these World Cups, some of them are viewed with nostalgia. People incredibly tell me, I was 10 years old during 1990 and I watched every single game. But actually people tell me no, it was a really defensive World Cup. And then you had a player like Toto Scarlatti, who came from absolutely nowhere. He was the last choice in the squad and through various injuries suddenly had this wonderful World Cup.
The Sicilian player.
Yeah,
from Sicily.
Yeah. And it went to Milan and had a couple of big transfers and barely did anything thereafter. So you do get the surprise package. James Rodriguez has not been fantastic since then. And you do get those sort of national teams. You see it the South Americans in particular.
I guess also last time round, the Chile side.
Exactly.
I saw them, they came to Wembley just before the tournament in a friendly and completely destroyed England, playing an extraordinarily energetic, high-pressing style of a kind that I hadn't really seen. And we were, you know, Alexis Sanchez, Arturo Vidal, that side. People were stunned by that Chile side. And they were brilliant for the first two games at the World Cup last time round. And in the end went out, I think, very unluckily to Brazil. But they were a surprise package to me, Stephen. I don't know about you last time.
Yes, I suppose Chile were a surprise package in terms of their kind of quality. I guess in 2010, Germany being exciting and not dour was a surprise to a lot of people. But yeah, I just feel you don't get the kind of same sort of, and you know, maybe we'll be looking back in 3 weeks' time and, you know, Nigeria will have found a way to make it click and we'll be going, oh gosh, you know, don't I feel silly now? But it just feels like that kind of thing doesn't happen in the same way because the game is so much more globalised and, you know, kind of almost everyone plays in the same way.
Before we talk about World Cup's past, I think we should have a little nostalgia section before we finish this first podcast. Should we just briefly talk about England? What do you think of the setup under Gareth Southgate, John?
I'm not so into the idea that Gareth Southgate suddenly is the thinking man's manager. we do like to, in this country, sort of get excited about sort of narratives. The current narrative is that he's more philosophical and reflective. And therefore,
there's a story in the paper today by someone who used to know him when he was younger, said he ought to go away and become a travel agent.
Okay, well, travel agent. The usual thing is a sort of the hint of one of these managers reading The Guardian suddenly becomes immensely sophisticated. I remember that of Brian McClare many years ago when it was revealed he read The Guardian.
And Graham Lasseau, too.
Graham Lasseau, another one. I think there's sort of a tendency to get carried away with the narrative. But he's slightly, he's fallen upon a formation and he's going to run with the formation. So I give him kudos for that. But I mean, Roy Hodgson.
But isn't it the formation that Aston Villa played, in the late 80s, early 90s?
It's a basically re-up version of Terry Venables' Christmas tree formation,
yes,
from Euro 96. Yes. Is an element of that. He's sort of running with it. But I mean, there was no master plan. He found the solution or his solution sort of halfway through qualifying. And even now there are unresolved questions over whether you play someone along with Henderson, where you can have Dele Alli and Lingard on the pitch. So, I'm not convinced there's some sort of hidden genius or, unhatched talent behind it all. That having been said, every time, every World Cup, the law of averages, if you think about it, England does have good quality players who in other national teams would be pretty effective and, probably the best, most on-form striker in Harry Kane. Real talent off the bench like Rashford. Sterling, you can't argue with the scoring record this season. I think Jamie Vardy's dangerous. I think England's got a weak goalkeeper. But also think it's not inconceivable the English team can do very well this year just by law of averages and by one other thing.
By very well, is it Stephen's last eight?
I think if you get to the last eight, then suddenly it's all open. There's no reason why England can't beat a Spain.
I haven't studied my route to the final, and I promise listeners I will do for next week. When I had an early look at this some weeks ago, it looked to me as if England may play either Brazil or Germany in the quarterfinal, if all goes well.
Yeah, but I think at the point you get to the quarterfinals, right, they're all difficult games. I agree that it feels that Southgate has found a system that fits the players he has semi by accident, but at least he does have a system that does seem to fit the players he has. You don't feel that this is an England side which just cannot score more than one goal a game to save its life. And they do have, they don't have the softest route to the semis. I think it's Argentina of all of the group, the teams who have got a really quite easy route to the final four. But they do have had quite a good route to the last eight. There are lots of good attacking players coming off the bench. Belgium look quite strong. It feels to me unlikely that this England team can be the best of the best.
Belgium underperform, though, don't they? The Euros, they were knocked out by the Welsh. Heroically by the Welsh. Well, they reached the semi-final. So Belgium do seem to have a problem at underperforming. Is it also to do with the politics of Belgium, being that this is called political football? The idea that Belgium itself is a kind of pseudo-state, John?
I actually don't think the politics... I mean, actually, you can say that of other teams.
It used to be said of Spain that it wasn't a homogenous nation.
Yeah,
or the
cliques in the Dutch national team. Sometimes they had sort of, racial associations too.
Yes.
I mean, Belgium's problems, I think, are footballing. Belgium has lots of problems as a state. But, I mean, the issues now are to do with managers in football. So this week he wants to play Martinez, the Belgian manager, wants to play De Bruyne quite deep, so we can allow these other players in position.
Is this the former manager of Everton?
Manager of Everton, who a lot of the players don't quite respect.
Yes.
And Lukaku's had a brush with. Yes. Nangolan, the really effective, wonderful Roma midfielder, is not in the squad.
They've
as well.
They've left him out, yeah.
So I think these are footballing problems. Last time they played Hazard in the centre of midfield and they couldn't get the most out of him. They've been more effective in qualifying than they... Well, actually, they were very good in qualifying last time as well. So I don't think those are the sort of footballing issues. You do get them in football teams as well. Just back in England, one point, I think, which is different than previous years. They look less exhausted going into the World Cup. You remember those World Cups of sort of Scholes, Lampard and Gerrard always looking quite tired after a Champions League semi-final.
Is that because some of the players haven't been playing twice a week?
Henderson's been playing a lot and a lot depends on his energy. But yeah, Rashford is sort of raring to go.
Lingard's been in and out
of the team. They're not sort of burned out. Harry Kane
was injured,
which sometimes can be a blessing in disguise. guys, but seems to have, you know, come back relatively sharply. And it is due an effective World Cup, isn't that effective in sort of national tournament so far? And also you do have energy at fullback, and you know that's a crucial part of the thing up and down the pitch. And that, you know, he's put, you know, middle or room in his squad for pace.
I like Kyle Walker a lot. I think he's a phenomenal athlete, and he's learned a lot playing under Pep at City. And I know Southgate looks like he's going to play him on the right of a back three. In other words, as a roving centre-back, bombing down the right flank, but with a right full-back advanced to his right, as it were. I think he's a phenomenal athlete. But Stephen, what do you make of Southgate? Rather polite young man, well-spoken, has a neat little beard at the moment. People have often said he's a lightweight and he's weak, but he came out of that incredibly tough Crystal Palace dressing room. Ian Wright, Mark Bright, you know, very dynamic Palace team from the late 80s, early 90s. So he's no fool or no stooge. And I think Ian Wright, you know, it's tough to earn the respect of Ian Wright. Wrighty respects him. So what do you think of Southgate?
I admire him for, you know, kind of rehabilitating himself after being relegated with Middlesbrough. He's talked a lot about that summer where he had to go around the club firing people because they went down, and how it shaped him. I like that he's been very protective of Raheem Sterling while the tabloids have been doing this kind of sort of typical thing of finding a scapegoat in the England squad to attack. And I do think, although I have my doubts about how he arrived at that system, right, the back three is a good system for England. And I think it's positive that he's come up through this system than Dan Ashworth and everyone else at the FA seems to have invested a lot of faith in, of having the youth team, the under 21 and the men's team play a similar system. So you have kind of a philosophy and not just a kind of like, let's try and bung all of our best players into whatever the fashionable formation of the week is, which does seem to be a little bit Belgium's problem, right? It doesn't make any sense to me why they're playing that back three, other than that Juventus and City have had quite a bit of success with back threes recently.
Well, England has the advantage of it has less superstars to squeeze into a team. Yeah. I worry about that English back three. I mean, I like the system. I think Kyle Walker has got recovery, but you can cover him at right back. And it's different playing for Pep City when you have 90% of the ball than it is for England. And often they've struggled to keep the ball. And I think in some games they will struggle to keep the ball. I think Walker is very poor at playing offside. I like Harry Maguire a lot. He's probably going to play him as well. He's sort of physical.
The Leicester City stopper. Although, yeah, as I understand it, he played every single game for Leicester last season. And they certainly leaked a lot of goals.
I mean, he was playing alongside a defence that should have been updated 3 years ago, yes. 2 years ago when they won the Premier League.
What about John Stones? He seems to make...
He's not going to be in the team, I don't think.
You don't? I think he might start. He's very good on the ball, but we'll see if he's in the team or not, but he makes a lot of mistakes, doesn't he?
I think he's like to play Cahill, Maguire and Walker as three. I mean, who knows?
And on the left, who will be on the left?
We can play Trippier, I think.
Trippier's on the right.
On the left will be...
Surely it's not Ashley Young, is it?
It will be Ashley Young, I think, at the moment.
I mean, you're a Manchester United fan, but from what I've watched of Ashley Young over the years, when he was at Villa and then since he's been at United, he just always comes back onto his right foot.
He does, but this is the issue with the left wing back. But actually, he puts in a lot of crosses. He's got very good assist rate at United this year.
You don't think it's Danny Rose, the Spurs left
hasn't
back?
Hasn't played enough this season,
no.
Has he?
Yeah.
No, I think it will be Young as first choice because he has played more. And I think also, one of the slight weirdnesses of international football is it's slightly more acceptable to have teams that are weirdly lopsided because you do have lots of teams which are fairly weak down the left. Obviously, Sterling gives you an outlet up front, but I assume that if you kind of imagine the kind of heat map, I assume England's heat map will be weirdly lopsided to the right side just because so many of our best players are right-sided at the moment. And so you kind of just have to kind of make the best of it.
And we don't have many top-class English players, unfortunately. I mean, the globalisation of the English league means it's very difficult for English players to get into the very best sides. But you wonder who's missing. I would like to have seen Oxlade-Chamberlain there, but of course he's injured. He was beginning to look like a very good player under Klopp. Jack Wilshere wasn't selected. Some say England's potentially their best ball-playing midfielder. I'm not so sure nowadays. I mean, he looks to me the injuries have taken a heavy toll. But Stephen, is there anyone you feel we're missing who could have been at the World Cup who's not?
I think in terms of that system, actually, I do think, although I don't think Wilshere should start, and I agree that he doesn't look like the player he was, the question I have about this England side is if it's minute 70 and they're down to 10 or they just want to hold onto the ball or defend, weirdly, it's not an England team that you can really imagine outscoring a lot of teams, but I find it hard to work out how it's going to avoid conceding late on. And the advantage of Wilshere, and it's sad to say this because this is not what I would hope I'd be saying about him at 26, is he is someone who can at least bring a measure of ball retention to a side, which is something I think this England team is going to struggle to do.
I think that's the kind of unanswered question, is whether he plays someone alongside Henderson, who puts Dyer in there or someone else. In the last game, and everyone was sort of talking confidently about it, they played Lingard and Ali sort of going forward. It's quite an attacking formation. I think England will concede goals. I think the goalkeeper situation is not getting rid of Joe Hart has been a sensible thing to do, because he's been disastrous in the last few tournaments. That having been said, you know, that those coming in are not effective. I think he'll pick Pickford because he's better with his feet. As far as I can see, the last 10 games of the season, balls are just flying past Pickford, and he did this Paul Robinson thing of diving after the ball's gone in the goal. I think that is a weakness for England. And I mean, that having been said, in World Cups, you do get these, you know, teams doing incredibly well with lunatic goalkeepers who try and be Rene Higuita types who try and play the ball out in the halfway line. So, you know, but
so you
think
don't think Pickford will do a scorpion at some point?
Possibly. I mean, that'll make the World Cup for me.
I think this is a solid England side, not inspiring. I think Harry Kane's potentially a great striker. Whether he will deliver at the tournament remains to be seen. I'm quite excited to see them. What I understand from sports writers who have been hanging around the camp is that they're a decent bunch. They've been open. They haven't got some of the swagger of the players of the past, despite their astounding wealth and comfort. And do you like this group? Do you think they're a decent group of guys?
They do seem quite likeable. I mean, it's the kind of sadness of, say, Welbeck, for example, is that I don't think he is quite ever going to make it as a top player, but he just seems like a really nice bloke. And then obviously ones who clearly are top players, like Raheem Sterling. There was a wonderful thread being shared by one of the Manchester Evening News' stories about how, you know, when he first met at City, he was the only footballer he'd ever seen who helped the PR clear the chairs away afterwards. And I think Raheem Sterling seems like a really decent guy who's dealt with a lot of extracurricular nonsense from some bits of the press. And it just seems, on the whole, quite a likeable team. I mean, it's quite nice knowing that there won't be an England team with John Terry in it, which always kind of did slightly spoil the experience of watching England.
Yeah, I think there's less of a hierarchy in this England team. I mean, beforehand, you did have this sort of wannabe or self-regarding Galacticos, even if they seemed okay, like Gerrard, and, you know, like Frank Lampard's turned into a decent fella after sort of early.
And there was
career,
always an obsession with one player, Beckham, you know, Gazza in the past, Paul Gascoigne, then Beckham, the whole celebrity cult around Beckham, which I find deeply tedious, and then Rooney more recently. And Harry Kane, who's, you would say, is perhaps the main man, because of his goal-scoring record for Spurs, and also he's the captain, seems like a very kind of modest young man indeed, rather humble and thoroughly decent.
Yeah, I think
there may
that's
be a
right.
big expose on him coming in a few days, which I don't know about, and this may be completely absurd, but as things stand, he seems to me a decent young man.
I think that's the kiss of death, so something might happen. I mean, the problem, there's an additional challenge, which he's got the captaincy now as well, which is a sort of additional burden. And there's a weird thing that England players do, sort of following the Terry Butcher folklore of getting overhyped for games. You'd see it with Joe Hart in the tunnel beforehand, and I hope this England team doesn't sort of fall into that trap, because that's why they collapsed against Iceland last time. It's, you know, overhype, and it's not that they're not committed or psyched up, which is the kind of national criticism, you know, guys don't care enough. Is it that you know, they forget to do the things to win, and I think that's my concern about this England team.
Okay, well, when we reconvene for the second podcast, England would have played their first game, so we'll talk a little bit more about England. But before we go on this first podcast, we'll have a very brief nostalgia section, I think. World Cups past. Stephen, do you have a particular favourite?
Yeah, so I think my favourite World Cup, and this is where I'm going to annoy everyone else, I guess, by showing my... Actually, I think it's probably 98. It was just after Wenger had arrived and we'd won that double for the first time. It had a number of exciting French players in it. Looking back, of course, I realise that there's the slight taintedness, and this is what I'm going to air my kind of first conspiracy theory of this podcast, which is that I am certain the French government poisoned Ronaldo, right? When you think about it, they had the motive. We know they've done dodgy things to the global south before, And it makes sense. That would explain why he played so badly. But other than that, 98...
Those rumours persist as well, he was poisoned before the final.
Yeah, 98 was, other than, you know, the bit where the deep state interfered to make Brazil lose, it was a great World Cup. I loved watching it. It's my memory of the first bet I ever won on foot.
Did you back France to win?
I backed France to win.
Well, from the beginning of the tournament?
Because they had a lot of Arsenal players.
They did, yeah. So Petit and Vieira and others. Yeah. And
this young winger from Juventus called Thierry Henry. So I was very excited by them as an idea. Except Henry hadn't joined yet, of course. But yes, I was very excited by France, and I thought they would win because they had some Arsenal players in them. And they did. That's, I think, the last World Cup where I've correctly...
It was also, in that sense, a memorable World Cup, not least for the French victory, but also because the French side seemed to represent all facets of France. There were French Africans, French Caribbeans, French Arabs, famously with Zidane at the centre of the team. There was a Breton, Givache. There was a Basque, Les Azarous, in that team. It was an extraordinarily reflection of France as a nation and the French people. Is that fair to say, John?
Yeah, I think it did have that sort of feel to it, the sort of South Africa World Cup feel. I mean, not quite the sort of same healing occasion, but actually it did have that. And people made sort of quite a lot of it politically at the time.
They did, yeah. Because France is often, particularly with the Bonheur and some of the events we've seen subsequently.
I mean, that's the thing. What I also thought is subsequently that it didn't set France in any healthier course.
But at the time, there was this great flourishing, particularly around the figure of Zidane, the French Algerian, because of the traumas of the Algerian Civil War. And here was someone leading from the front who was proudly a French Algerian. And that was a moment of great national celebration. Obviously, what one now sees are fractures in the French state.
Yeah, but actually a wonderful football team that sort of, you know, has that precedent a bit to build upon. I actually fancy the French. It's not the original
around.
Thing to say.
What about
Stephen
mentioned France 98 as a tournament he particularly enjoyed. What about you?
So this is all probably related to age, I'm sure. Yeah. But this Italia 1990 had Pavarotti doing the theme tune. It had Scalacci bursting onto the scene. It had a wonderful Brazilian side. I remember had 24 shots on target against Argentina, who had one, but stole it in the last minute. Had players like Caniggia, Baggio with his socks pulled down before UEFA told you, FIFA said you had to have shin guards. It had an awful, ugly final with spitting and everything like that. But it was a really boring final. But actually, I thought that tournament was...
It also had an epic semi-final, England-Germany.
Yeah.
An England side that improved as the tournament went on. Bobby Robson, the coach, stumbled upon a new system playing Mark Wright as sweeper. Do you remember? And, you know, Gary Lineker was scoring goals. David Platt was scoring goals, and it was quite an excited England team that was getting better. They were lucky against Cameroon in the quarterfinal when they won 3-2.
Des Walker's wonderful
pace
player.
At the back.
Yeah,
Paul Parker had a very good tournament at the back. And then this epic semi-final against Germany, Italia 90. I mean, an epic, Stephen, that even today I'm pained to think about it because we lost in a penalty shootout very traumatically, and we would have been up against a very poor Argentina side in the final, and I think we would have beaten them.
Yeah. I mean, that's the definitional, you know, that's the DNA of modern British football is Italia 90, right? Where you know, England play heroically. There's a player like Gazza who bursts onto the scene. The one difference is no Rolls-Royce defenders, but there were Rolls-Royce defenders, heroic goalkeeping, you know, an exciting team, and it hasn't sort of been like that.
Well,
since,
some people say it was a very poor tournament overall.
Yeah, I mean, I still
can't remember
quite believe
it being
that.
So, yeah.
No, but that was the sort of line. It was very defensive. Obviously, the Italian team scored, the Scacchi would score these wonderful goals from 30 yards, but actually it wasn't that fluid a team. Brazil were the most exciting team who were kind of had it robbed. I remember crying when Brazil were beaten by Argentina. But that says it gives you investment. And also, Cameroon were wonderful and exciting.
Wonderful team.
Led
by Roger Miller, Stephen, are you aware of Roger Miller, this kind of veteran striker?
Yeah. He's 42 or something.
Well, they say he was 42, 38, 42, whatever he was. He was older than your average footballer and had a tremendous tournament and used to celebrate with this little dance around one of the flagpoles. They were a terrific side and very unlucky to go out to England in the quarterfinals. And we're still, Stephen, awaiting our first winner from Africa. Pele used to predict there would be an African winner, didn't he, by the turn of the 21st century? Well, that hasn't happened. I can't see an African team winning this tournament in 2018, can you?
No, I mean, it depends. You can. So Nigeria, as is typical for the Super Group, go into the tournament in with some slightly difficult internal stuff going on. They have a new-ish coach. They do, I think, have the players to do it other than in goal. One of the slight mysteries of African football is it has never produced a top-class goalkeeper. There's a thing I always notice watching AFCON is the surprisingly poor quality of goalkeeping. But I do think Nigeria could, if they click, do it. Of course, I mean, that is the curse of Jose Mourinho, is destroying one of the most exciting, creative African players in John Obi Mikel to turn him into a kind of bog average holding player has really hurt the Nigerian national side. It's odd. So I obviously have no direct memories of Italia 90 being, you know, very, very, very newborn at that point. But the weird thing about looking at the lineup for it, and indeed Euro 96, which I do remember, is the thing about those successful England teams is they had players who played for teams outside of England. You had Lineker, who, of course, had left England. You had Platt, who'd been at Lazio. I think then there's something interesting. And weirdly, we talk about the globalised game.
Platt actually went after the tournament. He was at Villa.
Yeah.
And then he went to Bari.
Yeah.
And then to Juventus.
With Gaza and Walker.
Yeah, but you're right. There was a generation of players, particularly because of Italia 90 and how well they performed, then went to Italy, which was then the dominant league. Walker went to Sampdoria.
That's right.
And actually was destroyed as a player, I think, as a consequence. Yeah. Platt was very successful in Italy, particularly he got a transfer to Juventus. And then he also went to Sampdoria, I think, when Sven-Göran Eriksson was the coach there. And now, is your concern that England players are just stuck in England?
Yeah, I think, kind of in terms of, we talked about Jack Wilshere in part one, right? But one of Jack's sort of problems, right, he was offered the chance to go on loan to Bournemouth and then loan to Milan, and he went to Bournemouth. And I kind of think he might be a better player if he'd gone to Milan. And there's a weird Brexit parallel, right? Then in the 80s, you had Alf Wiedersehen and Pep, people using their free movement rights to leave the United Kingdom. And in 2016, you have the United Kingdom deciding, okay, albeit by a very narrow minority, that free movement was a problem that needed to be managed away, with all of the negative consequences that has for our economy and our productivity. And I do think the failure, not just of England players, but England managers, right? You know, Brian Robson had already been at Barcelona, right, by Italia 1990?
Bobby Robson,
yeah, yeah.
I think he went not long after, but he had been managing the continent. Yeah.
He went to the Netherlands, then Portugal, and then ultimately to Barcelona. But we're going to need to check our facts on Bobby Robson and report back to our listeners next week on exactly the trajectory of his career. The other key moment, I think, politically for Italia 90 was that English clubs were banned from playing in European competitions at that point because of the Heysel Stadium disaster in 1985. And the year earlier, in 1989, you'd had the Hillsborough Stadium disaster, in which, 92 Liverpool fans died. I mean, traumatic and horrific event. So Italia 90 lifted the cloud, this sense of despondency around English football, after which English clubs were readmitted into European competition. So it was a great moment of change for football. And the image of Paul Gascoigne weeping openly on the pitch during the semi-final against Germany was an enduring image, John, of that period, wasn't it?
Yeah, I wanted a whole podcast on Gaza stories on the basis of this. There's some great stories after he signed for Lazio, but
that's
for next time. Yeah, I mean, that was a significant moment. You're right, there was a kind of a hooligan-centric cloud over English football. It's also the prelude to the sort of excitement around the Premier League. And I remember what happened with Euro 96 thereafter, and a lot of, particularly Manchester United fans, that, you know, thought there was a lot of Johnny-come-lately, sort of, and football became too middle-class, too respectable thereafter. So it had both that opening up to the world again, but also that kind of more authentic side to it. You know, it wasn't fashionable to wear your England shirt and be, you know, down the pub supporting the England team because people thought you might hit them in the head with a pint glass.
That's right. So it's clearly a kind of hinge moment, a hinge tournament, because it was the end of the old football and the beginning of the new football. And the Premier League was 2 years away, and the whole globalisation of the game, and dare I say it, as it's the new statesman, the embourgeoisement of the game. On that rather pompous note, I think we should close the first podcast. As your guest, John, can I ask you for a prediction for this tournament, 2018?
Okay. Well, I was going to go to the bookies and put some money on England, just because I think the law of averages suggests they might do quite well. But if you had to push me, I think France will do very well, even though I think Laurent Koscielny, is he injured?
He's injured, yeah.
I don't think that they're going to miss Laurent Koscielny. Actually, I think he's a huge weak point. So they've got a very good goalkeeper, they've got decent defence, and they will score against anyone. A lot of it depends on whether Pogba manages to put the right boots on.
So you're going for France?
I'm going for France.
But you're going to put some money on England?
Just to make life more interesting.
Stephen, I'm going to ask you next week, I think, because you'll be back. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. Listening to Political Football, the New Statesman's new World Cup podcast. Thanks for listening to Political Football. We'll be back next week with another episode.
In the meantime, you can send us your questions and comments for future episodes via Twitter. I'm on at StephenKB and Jason is at JasonCowleyNS.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.